This is Rage, Radio Against the Global Ecocide. It is with great pleasure we bring you a special Fertile Ground show. The folks from Fertile Ground interview each other, providing great insights into today's issues. We'll have music by Testament, The Filthy Politicians, and Resident Antihero. This is Rage, building a community of resistance, one podcast at a time.
Hello, and welcome to Rage, Radio Against Global Ecocide.
Coming to you from Occupied Whatcom, we are your hosts, Max,
Cameron,
and Dylan.
And just a word of encouragement to all those wearing themselves down, trying to survive in this vicious state of global capitalism, to everyone doing their part in fighting empire, living their lives on behalf of the planet. That's all for the future generations.
My name is Dylan Thompson. I'm a co-founder and archivist of Fertile Ground.
We are standing before the forces of power.
My name is Cameron Murphy, and I serve on the board of directors of Fertile Ground. I serve as both event planner and student coordinator. Event planning is pretty clear, just try to set up different events throughout the year. And student coordination, I play a large role in our student-based organization on the campus of Western Washington University in Bellingham, Washington. The club's name is Against Civilization. It's a provocative title for a provocative club.
We're on the move now.
My name is Max Wilbert. I am on the board of directors of Fertile Ground. I serve as the officer in charge of security, legal issues, and nonprofit administration. And so I'll go through those one by one. As the security officer, you know, obviously we're an above-ground organization, so we have a much different security culture than a below-ground organization would have. But it is important as part of this deep green movement that we emphasize security culture and that we talk about it and that we promote it. And that's really my role in this position. Additionally, it's really important to make sure that we're personally safe. We're targets in this above ground role. And so it's important that we keep safety at the top of our minds. As far as legal issues, this is more of a role that we haven't had to go into too much yet, but I've been in contact with several lawyers in the area who are sympathetic to our cause and looking at some of the legal issues, talking over some of the legal issues of what we do. You know, people in similar positions to ours have been charged with things like incitement. They've gone to jail for multiple years. And so it's a really real thing that we have to be aware of, are these legal issues. We're not going to be very effective if we're in jail. So that's something that we watch very closely. And the third thing that I do is nonprofit administration. We are a state nonprofit, and we just sent in our federal nonprofit application. And the reason that we did this is above ground organizations need to take advantage of every opportunity that they have to advance their work. And that's what we're trying to do here. If we become a nonprofit, we'll be able to secure donations much more easily and fund our work much better. The other thing that I do for Fertile Ground is I'm in charge of the website. So our forum, our news postings, our videos, I'm in charge of all of that.
Well, Cameron, where is Fertile Ground at now?
Well, Fertile Ground. Fertile Ground at the moment is
in a pretty heavy process of federal incorporation. It doesn't sound like the most exciting or radical option, but it's something that we felt was necessary to do for our work, what we want to do, mainly radical environmental education. So a part of that, of course, is getting grant money, which we know that some activists are very opposed to, and you know, we're more than welcome to hear those criticisms, but we felt that it was, from our place, we felt that it was the best choice for us to make. So we recently sent in our federal nonprofit application. We're waiting to hear back on that. We're also developing a stronger internal structure, looking for an office space somewhere, just for a place to physically be located, somewhere that people could show up to as well. Once these things are set up, then we're hoping on getting donation money from people, and then we'll be able to move onto the road, hopefully move around the country, possibly up in Canada, other places, and start educating, start doing what we want to do, pushing the envelope with environmental education.
So how do you see that path of education when you get the funding and get all the resources so you're able to travel? Where does that lead? How will that education translate into the action that Fertile Ground endorses?
We've noticed that throughout communities, there's often small groups of people that share a similar radical environmental approach that we do, with the general understanding of civilization as very much the source of the problems and the situation that we're in. But it's very hard if you're just one or two people trying to get established, and it would have been a lot easier for us as well if we could have called an organization, brought them in, similar to the way that Derek and Lierre and Eric will go and do DGRs in communities. So just another option for that. So if groups call us in, we can come in and help put on either workshops or guest speak in classrooms, college lectures. And it really depends. You know, the more popular we get, of course, that just opens up the doors even more. And hopefully once we have found our niche, really, and when we get into these communities, help jumpstart certain groups. And then from there, of course, you know, we don't know how it will play out in the future, and it'll be up to the people that take it on from there to see where it goes. We're only, of course, still a small group of people, and we're just trying to see, well, there's a certain amount of faith that's involved going out there, speaking what we see as the truth, what we see as needed right now. And then it's up to other people, of course, to take that further and do what's necessary.
So what is this truth? What is, you know, getting back to the basics now, what is this, what's the problem, you know, in this current time? What are you going to be telling these communities in essence?
Well, here I would actually have to quote one of the mainstream environmental activists, Paul Hawken, who said that the health of every major life system on the planet is in decline, and that rate of decline is accelerating. And there hasn't been a single peer-reviewed published article in the past 30 years that contradicts that statement. So the problem is very simple, is that the life system is in decline, and the response from environmentalists and other communities, indigenous communities, has not matched that speed. It's been really, as much as people have tried and done really great work, it's nowhere matched that speed of decrease. And at the current rate, my God, I was just reading an interview, a peer-reviewed study recently in Nature magazine, and the authors wrote that it is reasonable to assume that at the current rate, by the end of the 21st century, two-thirds of the species on Earth will be extinct, two-thirds from where we are right now. And there's roughly between 5 and 30 million species on the planet, so we're talking about two-thirds of those being gone. I mean, that's, God, that's between, you know, 4 and 20 million species. And of course, that's not the world that we can, that's not the world we want to live in. I don't even know if that's a world that we could live in. And it's certainly not the world that we're wanting to leave for the generations that come after us. And that's simply from a human perspective, let alone the fact that we have no right to be taking away even however many species we are, 120, 130 a day. We have no right to be doing that.
Why do you think the mainstream environmental movement, the movement that's been around for 40 some odd years, has been ineffective as a whole? Why is the left these days toothless?
That's really one of the most important questions we can be asking, and in no way am I claiming to have the answer, and I don't think there is one answer. I think that the environmental movement, if we're even, you know, going to refer to it as a movement, that was really established in the 60s, starting with, okay, we can look at Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, as that really sparking environmental activism. One thing that I think about when I look at its inception is that it started around a general atmosphere of kind of the counterculture movement. And with that, there was a large rejection of political organization, hierarchy as well. And I see those patterns of being carried across very far, even still today, in the way that people organize. I see a general fear of political organization. I see the environmental movement as well. Many of the people trying to depoliticize the issue, and I think that's completely the wrong direction to move, because it is a political issue. Primarily, it's dealing with the distribution of power, the distribution of resources, the distribution and ownership of the means of production in society. It's fundamentally a political issue.
So when people think about the left, especially in the United States, Democrats, liberals, progressives come to mind, and this seems to be largely ineffective, seems to have been largely ineffective and continues to be. How would you define the left? How do you see the left today? And maybe what do you think needs to be thrown in with the left to make it more effective, to begin that path?
Well, I use the left. I know that some people actually really do not prefer using the terms left and right, and they kind of come from this postmodern position of using these labels is more confusing, and there's no such thing as left and right, and they're simply people, and they're simply people being political and expressing themselves. I still think it's a useful distinction to make. So let me, I guess, define what I mean when I say left. And again, it is very broad, I recognize. But when I think of the left, I generally think of, yes, Democrats, liberals, although often many times they fall very much into the center. But so when I say left, I'm thinking of really the people, the population that I expect, if we're going to make it out of the crises that we're in, the answers are going to come from this people. The action are going to come from this people, the left. Generally, I place my hope in the left. And even I still think it's useful to make a distinction between Democrats and Republicans. I mean, you're finding more anti-war activism, anti-war beliefs, environmental beliefs in general. So I think there's still useful distinctions to make, as well as it still helps to define the political landscape that we're in. What do I want to see added to the left? I want to see a general re-inclusion of the political, especially in the far left. I mentioned before, anarchist communities, for one. God, when I was just starting college, I went to a few anarchist, protests led by anarchists. These were the military, port militarization resistance efforts. And when we got together to organize, there was such a fear of hierarchy that we ended up following the consensus model, in which we sat around for what ended up being 5 hours of completely ineffective discussion. And by that time, of course, the police had already eavesdropped into the conversation, knew what we were doing, had already set up. I just read a book recently. It was a very useful book. It was called Dream, and it was by Stephen Duncombe. And Stephen Duncombe has been involved in certain activist projects as Reclaim the Streets and Critical Mass, which are both examples in the United States of people pouring, generally progressives, pouring back onto the streets. Critical Mass involves people riding their bikes. It's to raise awareness to the fact that cars generally have the authority on the streets, but that, of course, biking is better for less worse for where the places we live. And his point in Dream was that the left in general has lost its ability to fantasize. And, you know, let me distinguish, not of course, or by fantasize, he means to not simply base our politics on what we're against, but also on what we're for. And it's not in the usual sense of, you know, we can't be negative, we always have to be positive. Where when people organize politically, it's not always on rational means. It's based on other things as well. It's based on the ability of the social movement to tap into both their dreams, their desires, as well as creating an image of the kind of world that they want to live in. So I see that very much as well in terms of the left being very often reactionary. Our protests are set up as reactionary against what, you know, those in power are doing. I was recently up at the No 2010 Olympics protests. Of course, the entire thing, and I'm glad it was, I'm glad it happened, but it was extremely reactionary, of course. It's interesting to entertain the ideas. What would a leftist, progressive, radical politics look like that was trying to affirm something? Affirm, of course, right now, God, there's very little to affirm in the world we live in, but to try to fantasize, what kind of world do we want to live in? And instead of the general position of the left playing our moral conscience always there to remind us what we're doing wrong, or that all our clothes are from sweatshops, which of course is important, but what other positions could we take, and how would that be more effective? How would that instead not leave people feeling burnt out or guilty all the time and wanting to run away from leftist radicals, but instead wanting to be involved, wanting to be part of something. Very often you'll also hear with this, oh, this is just, you know, you're playing the manipulation game as well. And it's pretty typical of people throughout the left, from, you know, simple liberals, centrists, back to radicals, thinking that, okay, if we simply give people the correct information, then, you know, they'll make the right choice. So they base their idea of social change is based off of rationality. And if we've learned, you know, anything from the right, my God, it should be that rationality is one of the least important aspects of political engagement.
So in your work in Fertile Ground, how do you see yourself bringing in that positive image, the kind that Stephen Duncombe was referring to in his book?
Well, I think it's very easy, and I think, unfortunately, we haven't tapped it enough, because when we look around, if we were to stop and be honest, really, how many of us are really enjoying this way of life, living in a highly individualistic, technocentric culture where we're surrounded by alienating technologies, alienating advertisements, a media that we're not in control of, really a culture that we're not in control of, and what other alternatives are there that we could base our politics off of? Again, it's very hard to say because we we don't talk about these things, but for example, just one example, if you were to talk to people and say, would you rather live in a culture in which you don't control the media, so you're bombarded with capitalist advertisements, or would you want to live in a culture in where you do have a certain level of control over the media? And of course, we know the media plays a large role in shaping our desires and preferences. So the question comes down to, do you want to control your desires? Do you want to control your preferences? And you can really, I think you can spice that up a lot. I don't know exactly what that would look like, but again, playing off the romantic desires of people to live in a world. And it comes back to, for me, to the general point of anarchism, the point that, or the belief that no one is more entitled to control your life than you are. So there's really a lot of room for empowerment as well.
Max, you were recently in Siberia doing some research around climate science. Could you share a little with us?
Yeah, I was part of the Polaris Project this year. The Polaris Project is primarily a research project. It's a group of scientists and students travel to northeastern Siberia, right on the Arctic Ocean, to a region around the Kolyma River, a place called Chersky. And we conduct a lot of research around climate change. This region is really, really important to climate change because it's completely underlain by permafrost. The soil is frozen. And as the climate continues to warm, this permafrost is starting to thaw. At the beginning of the last ice age, there was a vast grassland in this area, and it sequestered a vast amount of carbon in the soil. And that carbon is still there, and it's just starting to thaw out. And so one thing that we're seeing is, as the permafrost is thawing, bacteria and microorganisms are getting into this thawing carbon store in the soil, and they're starting to eat it and respirate it back into the atmosphere as carbon dioxide and as methane. And this is what scientists call a positive feedback loop, because as the climate warms, more permafrost thaws, more carbon is available for the bacteria, they respire more carbon dioxide, and the climate warms further, and the cycle continues. There are other similar positive feedbacks in the region. One is with sea ice. Sea ice is a very bright white thing on the surface of the planet, and it reflects a lot of the incoming solar radiation back out into space. But as the climate warms and the extent of sea ice decreases, you have this bright white object that's replaced by seawater as the ice melts. And seawater is very dark. It absorbs a lot of the incoming radiation. So as the sea ice melts and the seawater temperature increases, that accelerates the melt of the sea ice, and the cycle continues and accelerates. So I traveled there with a group of scientists from all over the country and around the world, and we were looking into these positive feedbacks. And it was a very interesting time to be there because Russia is experiencing its hottest summer on record. Moscow broke 100 degrees Fahrenheit for the first time ever, and then broke it again and again and again and again in the same summer, multiple times. There are vast wildfires raging across Siberia. We saw the fires from the plane on our flights, and breathe in the smoke in Moscow. The smoke was so thick in the city that it was hard to breathe. The health departments in the city said that it was equivalent to smoking 2 packs of cigarettes a day. So that's what the whole summer was like for Russia. There were thousands of people dying from the fires, from the smoke inhalation. There was a vast amount of the wheat crop was destroyed. Russia is the second leading wheat producer in the world after the United States. So this has had a huge impact on global food prices and will continue to do so for the next couple months. And it was abundantly clear the entire time that we were there that these changes are accelerating and they're only getting worse. The scientists that I was traveling with have a very deep understanding of the ecology of climate change and the extent of the feedbacks and the physics of the situation. But one of their restraints is that they're still trying to appeal to a broad range, a broad audience, and so they're not radical in their politics. In fact, they're not political at all. They refrain from being engaged in politics in any way. And that really reinforced to me that we need to be the ones who bring this information out. Yeah, so it was really interesting to be around this group of scientists for such a long time because scientists are very left-brain people. They're trained in this linear, logical way of thinking and problem-solving. And they're also trained to be apolitical. In the U.S., we've seen the squashing of climate science for decades. We've known since about 1980 that climate change was happening and that it was accelerating and that it was caused by human activities. But one thing that we've seen is that scientists have not been leading the charge. There are obvious exceptions, the biggest being James Hansen, who first brought climate change to the attention of the world. And he's actually called for direct action. He said that politicians are not going to solve this problem. And he said that we need to take this to the streets and physically stop the coal from being mined and the oil from flowing if we're going to have any hope of stopping the climate change.
Could you talk a little more about the position that scientists are in, both the positions they take and the ways in which they are limited?
In working with a scientist, I was studying climate change one day, and I was speaking with a professor, and he was talking about the climate models, the computer models that they use to model climate change, and they're very sophisticated. They're three-dimensional. They take thousands of factors into consideration, and they're run on the world's largest supercomputers. This professor, he was explaining how these models are getting extremely more complex as time goes on. And he was also talking about the impacts of climate change and how horrific it's going to be and how the Arctic has already warmed 4 degrees Celsius, which is about 8 or 9 Fahrenheit, which is 4 times the world average. And I was speaking to one of my friends afterward. He's a science student. You know, he's a wonderful person. And I said, wow, isn't that horrifying? Isn't that terrible? Doesn't that shake you to your bones to hear that? And he said, yeah, but isn't it amazing how the models are getting so much better, so much more refined? And this just shocked me. And, you know, I think, you know, I use science all the time in my public presentations for Fertile Ground, in our work. It's an integral part. We wouldn't be able to do the work that we do without science. But at the same time, science, it inherently objectifies. It is an objective process. The scientist aims to be objective, and so objectifies whatever he or she is studying. And this is something that I think really limits scientists. Again, there are obvious exceptions to this, but scientists are the people who are seeing the destruction that this culture is causing firsthand, more than almost anyone. They are the people who are studying the declines in biodiversity, the dead zones in the ocean, the ongoing climate change, the effects of clear cuts, the effects of oil spills. They're actually studying these and seeing them firsthand every single day. And yet, they're not leading the charge. They should be at the front of the environmental movement. And they should be among the most radical voices because of what they see. But they're not. And so I think this is a case where those voices that are radical, like James Hansen, are very critical. But at the same time, by contrast, they're devalued. He's stepping out of his role, he's stepping out of his social position as a scientist when he makes these political commentaries. And because of that, his work is devalued. And in most of the public's eyes and in institutional eyes, he loses credibility.
In this culture, what has become more and more prevalent is the separation of age. Very often what's reinforced is the idea of the opposing or bad mother-in-law, the daughtery grandparents, or the annoying children. These are kind of relationships that are constantly reinforced in our sitcoms and our movies, and it's what people see every day. So I'm wondering what your organization does around the age issue, because there are differences that are important, but at the same time, we are all going to be at, or have been, or all going to be at any one of those ages throughout our life. So I'm just wondering how you see the relationship of age and community.
That's a great question, and I think that's really critical. It's something that I've seen a lot in my work as an activist, that division between ages, and I think it really diminishes the power that we hold and we're able to wield on the left. In Fertile Ground, we have somewhat a diversity of age. Our oldest member is 47. Our youngest member is 22 or 23. And we've worked with people who are quite a bit older and people who are in their teens. And I think that's given us a lot of strength. At the same time, I've seen a lot of other activists who are purely working within their own age group. And I think that each age group has something unique to bring to activism, to life, to anything that you're passionate about. Older people have wisdom and younger people have a different kind of wisdom. Older people have experience and younger people have passion and energy. I think that it's only when those are combined that you can fully realize the power of your community.
Max, let me also ask you, I know you have a strong critique about the separation of the different generations and mainly related to the fast pace of change within the cultures and then because of that, the relationship or the lack of relationship between the young and the old.
Personally, this is something that I've seen. You know, the trend in our culture is that grandparents grow old, they get sent to a nursing home, and they're isolated from the rest of the world and they die there. It's like a form of prison almost. It's really, really sad to me to see that. My grandmother is just moving in with my parents, and I think that's been a really, really positive experience that's brought our entire family closer together. Because now there's two generations living in the same house. Whenever I come home, there's three generations. And it really broadens up the experiences. Something else that I see a lot is the younger generation really looking down on the older generation. And this is especially happening in our current culture. You know, that we live in a culture that's based on progress and growth and technology. So as this quote-unquote progress continues, as the technological advance continues, the youth are engaging in activities that their elders don't even understand. They don't even know what it is. And this really creates a disconnect, and this is something that's unique in the history of the world. You know, traditionally, technology has advanced on a much slower, a much more human timescale. And what this has meant is that children would learn from their parents and learn from their grandparents and directly engage with them about the skills that they needed for everyday life. And I think that's a really valuable thing when you have that cross-generational communication and sharing of skills and practical skills, skills that are going to be important that you're going to use your whole life. That really creates a connection and it creates a reverence for the elders and it creates excitement for the new generation. So one thing that we also see with technology and the relationships between the generations is that in this progress-based society, this fast-moving society, there's no end point. We are growing exponentially. Our technology is evolving exponentially, but to no end. It's almost incestuous in that it feeds on itself and it multiplies on itself. The technology has almost taken over from the creators. And this is a really big contrast to traditional human life. I mean, 99% of human existence, our technology was directly related to the land that we were living on. And it was co-evolving with all the creatures that we shared that land with. And so when the ecosystem changed, when the patterns of the animals changed, our technology changed with that. And now we have this technology that has no link to the land. It's completely disassociated with it, and it's growth for its own sake, and it's really like a cancer. It's a disease that just spreads and spreads and grows until it consumes itself. And, you know, that's the point that this culture is heading for. It's going to consume itself, and in doing so, it's going to take down everything else with it unless we can stop it.
Dylan, we were recently involved in a local effort against the tar sands generally. Do you want to give us a brief summary?
After learning that a particular pipeline running through Bellingham carried product from the Alberta tar sands, we quickly organized around that issue, trying to bring awareness to the community about the tar sands and how destructive that project really is. And we wanted to see what we could do about it. So we organized people. We had an educational event where we had experts who knew what they were talking about come and educate people about the tar sands, about the resource-intensive process to the water-intensive process, the damage it does to the indigenous people living downstream from the tailings ponds, what it does to the non-human life, all that. And then we went in front of city council, and we made our dismay very clear to them. We did not want tar sands product in this city. And at meeting after meeting, we went back week after week to the city council meetings, and in the end, we managed to get the city to pass two resolutions. They're symbolic resolutions, but nonetheless, they passed them. And they basically both said that the city from now on is going to look for alternatives to tar sands fuel when they can, that we do not like the tar sands, and we do not want a part of it if we can help it. What was interesting was that this caused a firestorm in Canada. A lot of people involved in the industry up there were kind of mad at our decision, and people sent the city council nasty letters about, you know, I'm never going to come to your city again type of thing, or you've all been bamboozled by these young activists who don't know what they're talking about. And they've even offered to invite us up to show us how environmentally friendly the project really is, which is a joke. All you have to do is look at a picture to see that. But that's basically what we went through. That's the process.
You went in front of city council, let me get this straight. You went in front of city council because they were approving the franchise renewal agreement?
Yes, that's right. That's actually the reason that we started this project in the first place. The Trans Mountain Pipeline, which is the pipeline where the product would be coming through, was slated to be renewed. The franchise agreement that the city has with Trans Mountain was slated to be renewed. And so our first goal was to not let the city renew that franchise agreement. That didn't work because the Trans Mountain Pipeline, it's a transnational issue. And it would have been a lot easier if we were dealing with a municipal issue, just a local issue. But thanks to the Commerce Clause in the Constitution, the rights of Trans Mountain Pipeline trump the rights of city government. Now that's being challenged in places, and actually people are succeeding, but it's sort of an assumed thing that the Commerce Clause trumps city legislation. So that didn't work. The city didn't really feel like fighting against something that they felt would just shoot them in the foot economically. And I forget what the Trans Mountain Pipeline does for the city, like how much money it does bring in. I think it was negligible. It was like $10,000 a year, $15,000. So we were a little disappointed in the city for that, but we kept on it, and that's when we got the resolutions passed. The pipeline distributes the oil to multiple refineries in Washington, in Whatcom County, and that was why that it has some significance to us here.
What are your feelings now, considering the role or the power or lack of power of local government, city government?
That whole process, trying to stop the city from renewing the franchise agreement, the fact that it took us about 6 weeks to get two highly symbolic resolutions passed just really reaffirmed to me that bureaucracy is meant to slow us down. It is meant to slow any real progress. And I've seen this also on campus at Western Washington University, where I attend. We tried to get a student-run co-op on campus. And so we went up against the corporation, Sodexo, that has a monopoly on all food sales on campus. And we went into board meetings week after week after week. And they made these bureaucratic process that we all went through to try to come to a mutual conclusion. And we all got burnt out because it didn't go anywhere. They just didn't let us go through with the point we wanted to go through. You know, they wouldn't let us have a location. They wouldn't talk about where we could get money. And I don't know what we were talking about in those meetings, but it just went on and on. So essentially, my trust in government, in the legislative body, is virtually nil at this point. That people are going to have to, any change is going to have to be grassroots. It's going to have to be. I'm not saying people can't help out in city government. We've actually had some very helpful people who, you know, those resolutions wouldn't have been passed if it weren't for a particular city councilman who was very sympathetic to our cause. And it's something, you know, but you can only do so much.
What would you say to someone that would still encourage you or say to you, you have to work through the system?
I would first ask them why they thought that, because my experience is that that's not effective to get what we need. And I think about the fact that the system that they're talking about, you know, even just going as far back to the Constitution was written by white men who owned slaves, who viewed women as inferior. This system has inherent values in it that really work against justice.
One time you mentioned to me a recent survey at Western Washington University in an ecology class. Could you talk a little about that?
The class was Visioning Sustainable Futures, and the director of sustainability on campus, whatever that is, came into the class and asked the students to write about how we're going to get out of the environmental mess that we're in, how we're going to pass this ecological crisis. And what astonished him and scared him was that I believe it was 90% of the students wrote about an apocalyptic event. They could not imagine us getting out of the mess that we're in right now without an apocalyptic event happening first, without some sort of disaster. And this wasn't just, he could tell that this wasn't just the students being lazy and just trying to get from point A to point B. It's because they did not know. They tried and they didn't know.
What has been your experience with college students around environmental issues? We've seen that not many college students are active, but what has been your experience with their beliefs or understandings? Where do you think the average college student is regarding environmental awareness?
I think this culture has done such a good job at really just numbing people our age, you know, college-age people. I can probably ask the average college student, what does sustainability mean to you? Or what can you do to help the ecological crises? And more often than not, I probably will get the answer, you know, well, I try to buy local. I try to buy organic food. I try to recycle. I turn off my lights. I take shorter showers. And that's the people who are even aware. A lot of people still aren't even aware of the scale of the problem.
Talk a little about your experience leading the student club Against Civilization, what successes you've had, how you've seen students' responses in general.
Sure. Against Civilization is a discussion group on campus. We meet once a week, and we talk about a lot of different things, mainly our frustration with the modern environmental movement that's been around for 40-some-odd years, and yet every living system is in decline, as Paul Hawken has mentioned. We talk about everything from, you know, feminism to anti-oppression politics, indigenous rights, environmental issues at home and abroad, and I think most importantly, strategy to make sure that future generations of not only our children, not only our human children, but non-humans as well, have clean air to breathe, clean water to drink, and healthy land. I was up on campus tabling for Against Civ because it's the new school year, and all the student clubs set up a table and just to educate the new students coming in about their clubs. And it's so interesting sitting behind the table because you'll get people that walk by and see Against Civilization on the table, and you know they'll nudge their friend and just point and laugh and snicker and you know whisper some things, you know, who knows what they're saying, and then others will just come right up and they'll be intrigued and they'll say, "What is this? Tell me about it." And they'll sign up, and I can see it in their eyes that they're very interested. And then the more courageous ones will come up and be like, "Are you serious? Like, what are you talking about?" And I'll explain it to them, and more often than not, they'll sign up as well because they don't know what it means to be against civilization until I explain it to them. And then once last year, after the beginning, after everyone signed up and we had some meetings, we had great discussions. Sometimes it would get heated. Sometimes it would be emotional. Sometimes it would be talk about the science coming out of the scientific community. And overall, it's been a positive experience. And we've gotten a lot of people that want more than discussion. They want action. That's great. That's what we need. Now it's just a matter of providing those people with an outlet for their action.
Talk about what it means to be against civilization.
Yeah, this is a big one. Well, I guess we have to define civilization because that's what we're saying we're against. And the definition of civilization, you know, I grew up thinking that civilization just meant any way of life that humans inhabited. Any tribe, any culture, any city, any town, that was civilization. What I've learned recently is that's not necessarily true if you look at the linguistic and historic definitions of the word. Apparently, I think the Latin root of the word civilization is civitatis, which means city dweller. So once you recognize that civilization is the way of life characterized by the growth of cities, the emergence of cities, well, then you have to define what a city is. So if you're against cities, what is that? And a city is when a group of people live in such tight densities, in densities large enough that they can no longer support themselves directly from the land where they live. They have to go out, get what they need to survive, and bring it back to them. And the reason that we feel that this is inherently bad in two ways. One is that as your city grows, you denude an ever larger amount of land. That means sustainability is going to be problematic for you, for your society. And people have made the argument, you know, well, your cities do not necessarily have to grow. That's not the way it works, because that's nowhere has a city emerged and not had a tendency to grow. The other reason why cities and civilization is inherently problematic is because when you need resources from another watershed, from not where you're living directly, and you have to go out and get it, if the people living where those resources are won't trade you for those resources, you're going to have some sort of force to take it from them because you need that to survive. So the people living in the city can be the most peaceful people in the world, and yet they're going to need to be a military society because how else are they going to secure the resources they need to survive? And so our conversation sort of stems from there. Basically, civilization from its outset has been a net loss for life on planet Earth. More forests are pulled down, savannas and prairies are ripped up, oceans are murdered, and we are living in the end game of that destruction right now. When more than 90% of the large fish in the ocean are gone, there's toxins and flame retardants in every mother's breast milk. The U.S. Geological Survey put out a stat recently that said that every stream in the United States is contaminated with carcinogens. The situation is dire. The single issue activism that's plagued the environmental movement for 40 some odd years is not enough. I don't know what the future is going to look like. I don't know what my life is going to look like because of what I'm learning. That means to me that this culture, this civilization, has lost its privilege to exist. No one should be talking about this. No one should be talking about their children living in a biologically impoverished world where they can't get food and water. And this isn't even talking about the magic of the world. Humans have co-evolved with a lush, diverse planet with old-growth forests and flocks of passenger pigeons that darken the sky for days at a time, and seas of sea turtles that you could, you know, seemingly walk across because the sea was so full. Plains of bison take hours and days to to pass. It's just devastating on all fronts. And so I guess this brings up the point of how do you stay sane? You're battling civilization. It seems to be the most daunting task you could possibly give yourself. I think one of the reasons that the world is being destroyed is the same reason that so many cultures have been destroyed, so many human populations have been destroyed. The classic example is Nazi Germany. What did the Nazis have to do to the Jews before they could bring them to a concentration camp? Some part of their mind had to put in this inferior category. They had to silence them in some way. The Europeans who put the Africans on the ships and sent them over to the Americas for slavery had to do the same thing. They said things like, these people don't speak. When they speak, they fart with their tongues in their mouths. Or they would make up all kinds of justifications for why they were inferior. You know, size of their skull, distance of from their navel to the male's navel to their penis, all these things. And we've done the same thing to the natural world. We've silenced the natural world, which makes it okay to clear cut, blow up a mountaintop, pollute a river, dam a river. And so, yes, this brings a lot of anxiety and sometimes depression, but what also brings a lot of joy is taking away that silence, is lifting that silence, and actually listening to those who you're fighting for. There is a whole world of life out there that is waiting to welcome us home if we would only, you know, start to listen. The more and more people I talk to who have started listening, they're some of the most joyful people I know. We all know what we're fighting for.
You know that I miss you. I wanna get with you tonight, but I cannot, baby girl, and that's the issue. Girl, you know I miss you. I just wanna kiss you, but I can't right now, so baby, kiss me through the phone. Kiss me through the phone. I'll see you later on.
But all I can do is listen to your voice on this phone. We're digitally kissing through telephone wires till they let me out of prison. There ain't no love here, it's hate. And I'm missing my lover and community and family and living outside of these walls and the state and the system. It's a slave industry, so fight for abolition. I wanna kiss you for real, but until then I'll be singing. Lately,
you know that I miss you. I wanna get with you tonight, but I can't. Girl, you know I miss you. I just wanna kiss you, but I can't right now, so baby, kiss me through the phone. Kiss me through the phone. I'll see you later on. Later on. Kiss me through the phone. Kiss me through the phone. See you when I get home.
They tapping this call, and it's the only one I'm getting. Security culture, don't let them catch you slipping. Loose lips sink ships, so stop snitching, stop bragging, and stop gossiping. Cause you don't know who's working for the feds. They want us all in jail or dead. The prison industry is so widespread. It's got millions of us kissing through receivers on the side of our heads. Now,
lately, you know that I miss you. I wanna get with you tonight, but I cannot, baby girl, and that's the issue. Girl, you know I miss you. I just wanna kiss you, but I can't right now, so baby, kiss me through the phone. Kiss me through the phone. I'll see you later on.
Take what I can get. They got me locked up cause they know that I'm a threat to the system on which all these prisons depend. Liberate the earth, green's the new red. Gotta liberate myself, now I'm dreaming ahead to the day when I'll be free and I can see you again. Find peace and fall asleep in our bed. Wake up and kiss without a phone, get freaky instead.
Lately, you know that I miss you. I wanna get with you tonight, but I cannot, baby. I miss you, I just wanna kiss you, but I can't right now, so baby, kiss me through the phone. Kiss me through the phone. I'll see you later on. Kiss me through the phone. Kiss me through the phone. See you when I get home.
That was Testament with Kiss Me Through the Phone. The folks at Testament asked me to help promote the album Test Their Logic. It's a benefit album to help raise funds for their legal defense. The pop artists Testament and Illogic are facing serious charges from their alleged involvement in the historic protests at the G20 summit in Toronto last June. The album is available for free downloading, but we urge everyone to donate to support their fund. If you can't use PayPal, you can go to the site, and a link is on the website here, and you can go to the site and actually see how to send funds in other ways. I really enjoyed the interview with the Fertile Ground folks, and I really love what they're doing. I always say time and time again that they're the only folks that I know that are actually doing something that came out of DGRs that I've attended and that they've attended, and I'm actually doing something with the information that they've been given and to work with. And it's really great to see that. In part two of the Fertile Ground sessions, we'll be talking about community and their thoughts on community and how they see its importance in the resistance movement. Taking us out is Filthy Politicians with Concrete. Remember, folks, the resistance needs you.
And every time I step up in the field and everybody hands go up, and they stay there, yeah. And they say yeah, yeah. And they say there. Won't tell ya to put your hands up in the air. We won't tell ya to put them anywhere, cause you can put them up or down. All that really matters is you listen to the sound and let it sink in. Get to thinking, the reality in the eye without blinking. Well, don't think that I don't realize it today. If you want to reach the hearts and the minds of the people that you need to be, sweep them off the feet. To reach deep underneath these sheets of concrete that they've been laying since you were playing in plastic sheets and running through creeks now filled with chemical leaks. Now tears are running down our chemical cheeks, cause we don't wanna go outside without makeup on. We can't have fun without Jager bombs, and this ain't the way it's supposed to be. Ain't supposed to lose somebody close to me in a car accident. We shouldn't have cars, but we're all so used to all these scars. We build our own prison, but we don't see the bars, and it shouldn't be so hard at night to see the stars. Won't tell ya to put your hands up in the air. We won't tell ya to put them anywhere, cause you can put them up or down. All that really matters is you listen to the sound and let it sink in. Get to thinking, the reality in the eye without blinking. Days we're taught conscious thought ain't hot. Your brain might be saying T-Pain, I am not. So I'm already working against the fence you might be sitting on. But if you're not, then just pretend. We can take a thought, follow it to its end. Just take a look around, what the fuck is happening? We shop till we drop the things that got made halfway around the motherfucking world by slaves. If you got eyes to see, take a look around. If you got ears to hear, listen to the sounds of isolation, domestication to the natural world. We're an alienation, then we sold the soul for sweet sedation. The lonely sex robots on TV stations shouldn't take flow bots to show the bourgeois the new boss is just like the old boss. So we won't tell ya to put your hands up in the air. We won't tell ya to put them anywhere, cause you can put them up or down. All that really matters is you listen to the sound and let it sink in. Get to thinking, the reality in the eye without blinking. So if you got a breath of life left and something inside you that's more human than machine to guide you, then you just gotta dig it up, listen to it, and we'll do it. You just gotta set it free, then we can get to it. Cause the real enemy is all around. Every day they're the ones that are holding us down. And they know as long as we don't know anything else, then we won't know what it's like to think for ourselves. And that's half the problem, is every debate is framed to accept the existence of the state. With history they write, lies they tell, so that we identify. And we don't rebel, we just eat the food. We watch the shows and we consume exactly what they want us to know. But before we were consuming, we were human at birth. Gotta find our way back, cause we're killing this earth. So we won't tell ya to put your hands up in the air. We won't tell ya to put them anywhere, cause you can put them up or down.
All that really matters is you listen to the sound and let it sink in. Get to thinking the reality in the eye without blinking.